This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. One of the great questions is why humans think and why we think the way we do. What makes us able to build complex societies and send rockets to the moon while the rest of the animal kingdom seems content to keep its paws on the ground? That question intrigued Duke University scientist Brian Hare. He wanted to understand how human psychology evolved. And he figured he'd get the answers from our closest cousins in the primate world. But surprisingly, he learned that dogs could actually teach us more. Dogs are domestic animals, and he saw that there might be something in domestication that could illuminate the dark corners of human psychology. Brian Hare is an assistant professor at Duke's Institute for Brain Sciences, and he joins us now in the studio. Brian, welcome. Good to have you here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
And with you and our listeners as well, 877-962 is the number to call, 877-962-9862 if you want to call. We're talking about animals today. We're going to begin with this research into domestication and psychology, and then we're going to kind of move on a little bit from there. So we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 877-962-9862. So give me a little better sense of the kinds of questions that you were trying to answer.
Well, really what we want to know is, as you said in the intro, why are we such an unusual species? You know, we build buildings, we work together to communicate with each other as we are now. I'm really interested in sharing information with other people, so I'm on your show. These are all really peculiar behaviors that humans participate in. So we're just trying to understand how is it that our species has become so strange relative to other species. So what we really believe is that to understand humans, what we first need to do is know what it is to be not human. And so we look to other animals to understand how they solve problems and how they think about their world so we can figure out how we really are different. Because what happens often in science is people have ideas about what makes humans special, and we end up being wrong when we start looking at animals.
And when we think about this problem in the abstract, we think, well, humans problem solving, the way we solve problems, and then, of course, having this opposable thumb so we can actually make the thing that we dream up. but the thought process. But then you came on this idea that domestication is somehow a factor in our psychology. What's the link?
So I think the punchline here is that for most scientists, the way that we think about how humans became so unusual is that nature basically favored smarter individuals, and that basically to get a smarter human being or species of human, well, the smarter individuals did better and they had more offspring and they were more successful. But what we've learned by studying domestication and domesticated animals is, one, we've figured out what domestication actually is. And the second lesson is what we've learned is it's not necessarily best to be smarter if you want to win the evolutionary game. Really, what probably made a huge difference in the beginning of human evolution is that we got friendlier. And that if you want to be smarter, you actually have to be friendlier first. And that's what we've learned from domestication.
All right. Well, let's talk about this definition of domestication. What do we mean when we say that?
So domestication is when the distinction should first be made between domestication and tameness. So if I take a wolf or a wild animal, and I hope that people don't normally do this, but if you were to take a wolf from the wild and raise it from a young puppy, well, it would grow up to be tame, and some people would be able to interact with it to a certain degree, but it would still be a wild animal. The biology that makes it a wolf would be the same, and so that's what makes wolves unpredictable, and they're horrible pets because they might bite you, et cetera, et cetera. But it would be a much more tame animal than, say, if you took an adult wolf from Yellowstone and brought it into your family. So that's tameness. You haven't changed biology. What you've done is changed sort of the rearing environment of the animal. So what domestication does is that's when selection actually favors friendly individuals, and it really changes the biology of an animal or an entire species.
So that's how we and dogs became friends and live at the same campfire.
That's right. And so, you know, when you think about domestication and our relationship with dogs, the typical way that people think about it, and myself included, before I started really, I accidentally started studying this, but, you know, if you'd asked me, I'd said, well, how did domestication happen? Well, people love animals, and we brought animals into our home, and we just decided, you know, it'd be great to have dogs, and so we made dogs in our own image from wolves. But the more that you delve into it, the more you realize that that story really doesn't make much sense. Because if you study the archaeological record from when humans first started to settle, and this is about 14,000 years ago when humans started having agriculture, well, the last thing that you would really want is a wolf hanging around. Because while people were transitioning to agriculture, people were still hunting. And of course, who was your main competitor? It was the wolf. And so, why would you want to be friends with this animal that's eating, you know, this precious food that you're going to necessarily need? Because in the beginning, humans were not typically very successful with agriculture. So, you know, if you're already on the edge, why in the world would you bring your competitor into your own home? And so this realization made people start thinking about our, you know, the origins of our dog relationship differently.
And it may be then that dogs, wolves, began domesticating us or changing themselves because they found that it may have been an advantage to hang around this particular brand of hunter.
So exactly. And the idea is that domestication is really when a human decides to start intentionally breeding dogs in a different way. And that goes on all the time now. And it's gone on since the Victorian age, you know, 150, 200 years ago. But before that, actually, there isn't much evidence that people were intentionally breeding dogs. And there's about a 10,000 or 12,000 year window there where what's going on? Because there were dogs, but there weren't lots of dog breeds. And the answer is exactly what you said, is that actually wolves chose us and we didn't choose wolves. Because the key thing that happens is that humans about 12, 14,000 years ago begin to settle. Well, what happens when humans settle? Well, they do what humans always do, is they make a lot of garbage. And so if you're a wolf who is out running around trying to find prey and you happen on a human settlement, well, humans are, you know, a very scary thing. You don't want to hang out with them. But, oh, ooh la la, the garbage is just too tempting because, of course, we eat almost the same stuff. So how does this then lead to domestication? Well, if you're a wolf and, you know, normally you're scared of a human being and your response should be that you should run away. But if you can – if you are a wolf who, for some reason, your biology is a little bit different than most wolves and you don't have the same fear response that other wolves have and you can approach the garbage, well, you're actually going to be better off and you're going to be able to reproduce at a higher level than those who are more fearful.
Not only should the wolf be less fearful of the humans, but they should look more less fearsome to the humans who is very likely to chase you off. So they had to do something about that.
Right. So this is literally a story that I've just told you now. So how do I know that it's actually science? Well, the interesting thing that has happened is that over a 50-year period, a Russian scientist by the name of Dmitry Belayev decided to really test this idea. And what he did is he took a population of foxes and he divided them into two groups. One group that he was just going to keep as normal foxes on a fox farm, and then another group of foxes that he was going to intentionally select to be less fearful and less aggressive towards people. And so then what he could do after he selected them for many generations is he could compare the two populations and see what his selection did to the foxes. Okay, so remember, both populations start out identical. 20 generations after the selection, he has foxes that are less fearful and very friendly towards people. But here's the fun shocker, is that the foxes have floppy ears and curly tails and different colored coats, and they change sizes, their skulls change shape, their skulls get smaller and more feminized, and essentially, their teeth get smaller. And so essentially what he's created is a domesticated fox.
They got a cute gene.
They absolutely got cuter. And so what he learned was that if you select against aggression, you accidentally also change all these other traits because the genome is linked. So genes have multiple jobs. They're very busy people. And so the gene that is in charge of controlling the level of aggression in an individual, well, it also is responsible for lots of other things like the cartilaginous tissue in your ears or the shape that your tail is getting up, et cetera. So if you change aggression, by accident, you change all this other stuff.
Well, by accident, or maybe there's a design factor in there too. Aggression is, unless you can express and communicate your aggressive intention, what good is it? So pointy ears, sharp tails, all those things are fairly closely linked, I would think, with
aggression. Well, absolutely. And it certainly is true that they're linked in terms of the mechanism that the developmental mechanism that controls them. So you change aggression, you have to change the development of the organism very early in their life, even actually in utero. And so while they're gestating, and so if you tweak this gene, then you tweak everything else. And so they're connected.
If you're worried about aggression, like a human might be, you learn to pick up those cues. So pointy ears, sharp tail, stay away. Floppy ears, curly tail, give them a hug.
Absolutely. So what Belyaev's experiment does is it makes us realize what is domestication. And domestication is actually selection against aggression. So let's go back to the wolves and the dogs. The story actually makes great sense at this point, because if wolves pick humans and start using our garbage, the individuals who overcome their fear, become more friendly towards humans, by accident they're going to start looking a lot like the animals that we spend a lot of time with all the time. And of course, we really respond to that, that they look really cute. And here's the crucial thing that links all the changes together, the behavioral changes in particular, is that they all favor being more juvenile-like. So the foxes, if you look at the way they vocalize, if you look at the way they interact with humans, if you look at any of their behaviors when they interact with each other, it's almost like they're frozen as juveniles. They never grow up. And that's probably what happened to wolves as they evolved into dogs.
We're going to take this a step further and find out how we brought this into the primate world. And the research came full circle when my conversation with Brian Hare continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about human relationships with animals. Brian Hare is with us in the studio, assistant professor at the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences. So we're talking about domestication, how it may have worked, the fact that animals may have chosen us. You study this, you begin thinking about dogs, but you go back to your favorite primate, the bonobos, and you carry the research a step further. Tell us about that.
Well, so we learned this about the foxes, and we learned this about the idea of what happened with dogs and wolves. And so we started to think, well, is this something that we could apply to nature? If it is that wolves evolve by interacting with humans, is it that nature can actually favor a friendlier animal? Because normally when you think of evolution, people think about competition and how, you have to outcompete everybody and, for resources, et cetera. So this is a slightly radical idea, the idea that nature could actually make an animal friendlier. But when you start to look at lots of different species, there is variability in how animals interact with each other. And if you take the bonobo as a case, bonobos are the closest relative of us, but also of chimpanzees. So we have really sort of two sibling species. You, just like you have a sister and brother, they're equally closely related to you, but they're very different. And so that's what we have, is chimps and bonobos. But bonobos are a real evolutionary puzzle because they have a very small cranium relative to chimpanzees. They have very small canine teeth. They've never been witnessed killing one another. They do not coerce one another into mating. And females are either co-dominant or dominant to males. They're very playful and they're hypersexual. So all of these things are very similar to what you observe when you compare wolves to dogs. So what we started to ponder was the idea that actually bonobos have not become domesticated, because humans weren't involved, of course, but perhaps they've become self-domesticated. They domesticated themselves. And nature basically favored individuals that were friendlier.
Well, that's just a kind of socialization. I mean, chimps are famously aggressive, hierarchical. They haven't changed. So there's nothing about the bonobo that's convinced the chimp from an adaptive standpoint that that's a better way to go. It's still better for chimps to be chimps. And that's how they socialize. And bonobos have come up with their own socialization or domestication, as you...
That's right. So basically the idea is that chimpanzees have a darker side like humans do, and that basically the environment that they live in favors that. But in bonobo land, there's actually been biological changes to them. There's been heritable changes that have actually made them friendly. And so we've gone and tried to test a bunch of ideas about this. And so, for instance, we've looked at how they respond to stress, social stress. And unlike chimpanzees, who, if they're faced with the opportunity to share food with one another, male chimpanzees have a huge spike in testosterone and no spike in cortisol. So testosterone is a hormone that sort of prepares you for competition. Cortisol is a hormone that sort of responds to some kind of social stress. So if you're on an awkward blind date, for instance, you probably have a raise in cortisol, for instance. So bonobos have the exact opposite response. They have no testosterone increase, and they have a huge cortisol response. And so the idea is that chimps, when they are in a place where they might have competition, they get ready. They're like, I'm gonna throw down, guys. Whereas right. bonobos get really stressed out. Oh, my God, we're going to fight. No, we have to find a way to get over this. And so that's really a really concrete biological difference we can point to that says that this is evolution that's occurred. It's not just some kind of cultural difference.
Yeah, but and what we don't know is whether, you know, so, but nature is still, the verdict is still out on whether or not one of these is gonna actually dominate. We've got them both. We have to live with them both, and they ain't a winner yet in terms of the kind of behavior that would be more successful generally.
It's a very PC message because they're both winners currently because they live on opposite sides of the Congo River and they don't interact with one another. So actually, there probably won't be a contest between the two of them. But the idea is that basically something about bonobo's environment favored females being able to hang out together. And because they could hang out and form bonds, they could support each other against males when males became aggressive. And so essentially, females do not tolerate male aggression. And because females don't like aggressive males, well, the cost of being that aggressive male doesn't pay off anymore. What's the point of being the alpha male if being alpha doesn't pay off and being able to be more successful?
If it doesn't give you – you don't get a date, what's the point?
What's the point?
That's the point. Well, we're going to continue this conversation and expand it at this point because joining us now is Wayne Pacelli, and he is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, author of the book The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them. Wayne, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
We're taking phone calls as well, 877-962-9862, talking about our relationship with animals, how we treat them. As I say, we have Wayne Pacelli from the Humane Society here, and give us a call at 877-962-9862. Do you have a cat or a dog or another pet? Is that part of your family? Do you have a special bond? Give us a call. So, Wayne, you tell us a little bit about your book. You, in this book, talk about our relationship and the fact that humans have this genetic bond almost with animals.
Well, my book is really kind of a big picture meditation on our human relationship with animals, with domesticated animals, with wild animals. And one of the theses in my book is that we do have an instinctive bond or connection with other creatures. And if you look at the manifestations of our relationships with animals in society, you see, 2/3 of American households have pets. We have 171 million dogs and cats in our homes. The cats climb on our kitchen tables. The dogs sleep on our beds. There are another 80 million of us who are active wildlife watchers. We've got all sorts of television programs that show animals, whether it's Animal Planet or Nat Geo or Discovery. I mean, animals are part of our lives. They've never been kind of a sidelight to the human experience. They've always been at the center of the human experience. And I argue in the first part of the book that there are actual, you know, there's some biology to this bond. There's some biochemistry to the bond. And that we have certain social bonding hormones that connect us with other creatures. And if you look at our history, we've been immersed in nature. And we've been connected to animals throughout our human experience. And today its form, you know, is different than it used to be. But that's only part of the story. A lot of my book also talks about where this bond has been broken. And how we as humans are exploiting animals because we have the power. And that sort of connectivity that we have with animals is powerful, but it can be easily overcome by our attitudes of exploitation, profit, etc.
Well, how would you say the bond is broken?
The bond is broken in so many ways in society. I mean, that's really the work of the Humane Society of the United States is to address these instances where the bond is broken. Puppy mills, where you have large-scale dog breeding operations that churn out puppies for the pet trade, denying the breeding females adequate space. You know, they live in a wire cage. They're outside, you know, forever. They aren't properly socialized. They're denied vet care. factory farming, the industrial production of animals for food. You know, farming and domestication involve the connection of the farmer tending to his flock. Now we have these industrial farms where there's no relationship between the farmer and the animals. I mean, sometimes on some of the enormous facilities, there are thousands or tens of thousands, or in the case of birds, hundreds of thousands of animals. So we've got animal fighting, we've got seal killing for fur, we've got captive hunts where people shoot wild animals or exotic animals in fenced enclosures for a fee. I mean, these are all expressions of our human dominance over animals and a lack of restraint in recognizing that these animals matter and that we have duties and obligations to these other creatures.
Still, when you think about our first relationship with animals as a species, as humans, we were first hunters before we settled down and before animals were domesticated and they became our pals. So our first relationship with them was to kill them and eat them.
Well, there are contradictory impulses that exist within society. They've always existed within society, and they've even existed within the same individual. At the same time, when you look at hunting and gathering societies today, if you look at communities in New Guinea or in Brazil or other parts of the world where you do have tribal societies, there is killing of animals, but it's for need. And there are rituals of atonement. There are apologies offered to the animals. It's not this kind of, you know, I don't want to romanticize it too much, but there is a relationship and a connectivity. And it's not this kind of industrialized exploitation of animals where we're so disconnected from their lives. A lot of these tribal societies, they know all the animals in the forest. They know the behavior of the animals. They think they're going to come back as animals. And there are notions of respect that are built into their daily outlook with animals. And, you know, our society has so many expressions of love and appreciation for animals. We have so many standards that tell us to be good and decent animals. We have laws against cruelty. Yet in our very same culture, we have this mass exploitation of animals. And that's where you get a group like the Humane Society of the United States that's trying to sort this out and show a new way forward for all of us in society.
You know, another group that you would think would be interested in the care of animals would be the American Veterinary Medical Society. But in your book, they come into some fairly heavy criticism.
Well, the vets in this country provide essential services for animals. And, you know, most vets these days are small animal veterinarians. They're dealing with dogs and cats that are pets, and they're providing necessary and critical medical services to animals, as well as spaying and neutering surgeries and all sorts of other things. But if you think about historically the role of the vet community, a lot of vets used to work for the industries that cause harm to animals. They work for the factory farming industry. They work for certain elements of the, you know, racing industry, or they were lab animal veterinarians, many different types of vets. And a lot of those vets have adopted the ideologies of these industries that cause harm to animals, and they come as veterinary subgroups to drive a lot of the decision-making at the American Veterinary Medical Association, which is the association of all vets. We're seeing an incredible change. It used to be that 90% of vets were males, and they used to be more agriculturally oriented and adopting those attitudes. Now 90% of vet students are females. They're going into small animal medicine, and with this new profession, they are bringing new attitudes of more compassion and mercy toward animals.
Let's go to the phones now, 877-962-9862. Cullen is on the line from Chapel Hill. Cullen, you have a question for us?
Yes, thank you, Frank. So this is just a wonderful show. I'm on a cell phone. I'll try to keep it quick. I wanted to ask about this selection for fearlessness. I recall 20 years ago in a Scientific American article, information about this Russian doctor, researcher, and it's absolutely fascinating. And the article was actually about why dogs bark anarchically and chaotically the way they do, and it's this selection for sort of juvenileness. But my impression from the article was that it was more a question of what was being selected for was submissiveness rather than submissiveness in as non-aggressivity rather than fearlessness on the part of the wolf. Because when I think about it as a Neanderthal, I would rather have a submissive wolf than a fearless wolf. And there was also some information about perhaps these early animals being animals which couldn't hunt for themselves anymore or were somehow handicapped or damaged.
Well, let's get an answer to that, Colin. I appreciate it. Thank you for your call. Brian?
So So what's interesting is a lot of people, when they think about our relationships with dogs, they think that the right comparison when you're thinking about dog social systems is to think about the wolf social system. But actually, I think the right comparison is the feral dog social system, because when you look at how feral dogs, when they leave sort of human companionship and they go live amongst themselves, well, the social system is very different. And the way that it's different is – the key thing that's different is that feral dogs do not follow the most dominant individual in their group. They follow the individual that has the widest social network, who has the most friends in the group. So so while I understand the question is, you know, essentially, wouldn't a human favor a submissive individual – well, I don't think it actually plays out in the actual behavior of dogs. I think that dogs really prefer really friendly individuals, and that I think that's really the main thing that people were looking for, is somebody, an animal that was not aggressive and friendly.
Right. But, I mean, I guess you could take friendly as sort of – as not aggressive or submissive. If you're going to be friendly, you're going to sort of want to get along and not rip off the piece of meat from the fireplace and take it.
So part of the problem is that the submissive signals of dogs are highly correlated with juvenile behavior. So are they being submissive or are they being juvenilized? So are they being more like young puppies?
You know, Wayne, I want to ask you a question, and it's a bit of a philosophical one. But if you think about domestication, this kind of evolution of behavior and relationship, as we become more distant from our own food supply, as we become more acculturated to having food come to us from sources we don't know about and don't want to know about, does it kind of change us? Does it change the way we see animals because we don't have to interact with them anymore?
Well, I think that the rise of pet keeping in this country, certainly in the 19th century, was in some ways a reaction against our separation from nature. I mean, we had newly emerging cities in the 19th century. We were disconnected from nature. And I think we have a deep craving to be around animals and to be within nature. And I think that pets served that function. It became truly a middle class sort of practice. It was used to be reserved for the elites in society. And it really became kind of democratized, and everybody got involved in this enterprise. And now we look in our society today, it crosses class, it crosses race, region, urban, suburban, rural. We love pets. They're part of our lives. And I think that's part of our connection to nature. And, you know, around the same time, 1872 was the first national park created in the world. It was Yellowstone National Park. And we have obviously created a broader network of national parks, 80 million acres in this country. And we go to forests and we go to state parks. I mean, we crave interactions with nature. And I think as we become separated, there's something that propels us and bonds us and binds us to nature. And these are some of the manifestations in our modern world.
Let's go back to the phones now. Lori's on the line from Norfolk. Hello, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Got a question for us?
Yes, I first just want to say thank you. I really appreciate this conversation and anything that gets people thinking about animal rights. And I guess I really love Wayne Pacelli's book, and I'm curious what you think the future for animal rights will be and what can we do to support that beyond just becoming vegetarian.
Well, there's obviously a very broad social movement. We calculate about 20,000 animal organizations in this country. HSUS is the largest of them. And it takes us into these many different domains of agriculture and science and wildlife management. You know, here in North Carolina, I just must say there are a few issues that are just crying out for attention. This puppy mill issue. We have no statewide rules to govern large-scale commercial breeding operations. The legislature has not taken up bills and not passed bills that would address this problem. And even groups like the North Carolina Pork Producers Council, the pig farmers, are against this because they fear any advance on animal welfare is inevitably going to result in some reforms that they're going to have to contend with someday.
And a puppy mill would be?
A large-scale dog breeding operation where they're churning out puppies for the pet trade, and the animals who have it the worst are the breeding females who are bred typically every single heat cycle. We've got another big issue, dangerous wild animals as pets. There are no rules at the state level. You can have tigers, chimps, Burmese pythons, and other dangerous animals. And this is something that most states have banned, and we've got to get this done in North Carolina.
Most, but not all. And I'm not saying that what happened in Zanesville, Ohio, could happen here, but...
Exotic animals, wild animals on the loose. What may be the biggest release of dangerous carnivores in U.S. history? the frantic 911 calls.
911.
Yeah, there's a lion on Mount Perry Road in Grayshaw.
I'm pretty sure, and I just saw a wolf.
I think I just seen one. Looks like a jaguar or a wolf or something.
Deputies with shoot-to-kill orders used their pistols to take down lions, tigers, bears, and wolves before the sun went down.
That was a pretty rough story. Zanesville, Ohio. In fact, the guy committed suicide, let the animals go. He had some 58 animals that went out, and luckily no humans were killed, but it was awfully close.
North Carolina is one of seven states with no rules, again, at the statewide level on this. Some of the counties have rules because they're trying to fill the gap that exists because of the absence of policy on the state level. There have been people killed by tigers here in North Carolina. The issue is not just one of public safety. It's also an issue of animal welfare. These animals don't do well in people's basements or backyards. They are wild animals, as Brian has been talking about. We cannot recreate the set of environmental circumstances and cues that these animals need to have to live a fulfilling and enriched life. And you get amateurs, laypersons, who have these animals on some sort of exotic fantasy. And then typically what happens is they relinquish the animals, and then groups like ours, the Humane Society of the U.S. and other groups, have to care for them for the rest of their lives, costing our community hundreds of millions of dollars a year in dealing with the reckless decisions that people make to acquire dangerous wild animals as pets.
On the State of Things today, talking to Brian Hare, assistant professor at Duke's Institute for Brain Sciences, and Wayne Pacelli, who's just been talking with us. He's president and CEO of the Humane Society and author of the book, The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them. And your phone calls at 877-962-9862 when our program continues. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about human-animal relationships. With me in the studio, Brian Hare, assistant professor at the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences. Wayne Pacelli is president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, author of the book, The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals and Our Call to Defend Them. And your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Let's go right to the phones. Karen is in Siler City. Hello, Karen.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I just appreciate you addressing this subject, but Wayne Pacelli did leave, I think, your audience with some the wrong impressions of just what about the veterinary community and about what he's calling factory farming. And one thing is, he did say one thing that's true: the veterinary community is becoming more and more female dominated. And I am a large animal veterinarian, and I do work with the farming community and the large animal farms, the dairy farms especially. And I just wanted to say that in my career, I see the most compassion and caring for our farm animals than I ever had in the 25 years that I've been in large animal veterinary service.
Well,
I think it goes without saying that you see the tremendous efficiency and increases in production with our farm animals, and this is not going to happen if our animals aren't being well cared for. So I just hate for him to make such a statement and leave that impression with the community that our factory farming, the industrial farms, as he calls them, are a bad way of looking after animals.
All right, Karen, well, let's get a response. Thank you for your call, Karen.
Well, certainly, you know, veterinarians, are doing very, very critical work. My argument has been that some veterinarians, especially veterinary subgroups that work for these industries, adopt the ideology of the industries. And I think if we look at pork production, North Carolina is the number two pork-producing state in the country, 10 million pigs killed. You've got the biggest pig slaughterhouse in the country in Tar Heel, North Carolina here, 42,000 pigs a day, something extraordinary. What the biggest criticism that we've leveled on pig farming is the treatment of the sows. These sows are in 2-foot by 7-foot cages called gestation crates. And they're in there for a 4-month period, then they're moved to another crate, they're reimpregnated, put back into the gestation crate. They can live 3 or 4 years effectively immobilized, where they can take one step forward, one step back. This is no way to treat an animal. And even if you can have production and productivity, where the animal's growing or they're producing piglets, that does not equate with welfare. There's been a notion among some in industrialized agriculture that if the animal's productive, that means that they're okay. Well, we know that people can reproduce if they're in terrible circumstances as well, and we can do better than this. animals raised for food are essentially, you know, giving up their lives, we're taking their lives for the benefit of humans. And are we this miserly? Are we this uncreative so that we don't even allow animals built to move to engage in the most natural and normal behaviors? And this is really the essence of HSUS's critique of factory farming, that the animal's nature has been frustrated by this immobilization in these cages and crates barely larger than the animal's body.
And one of the ways to make all of that possible is by the heavy use of antibiotics and other things that make it possible to cram animals together. I think the point you make in your book is that for that segment of the veterinary population, which I think you put it about 10%, that's working in industrialized farming, the focus seems to be on the herd rather than the individual. How do I keep them all alive? So if I lose a few individuals along the way, if I have to dose them with antibiotics at whatever cost to human and animal health, the possibility of resistance and all of that, well, so be it. We may have to lose a few.
That's right. It is really more of a population-based approach to health of the animals rather than individuals. I mean, if you have thousands of pigs at a single facility, no vet can attend to these animals' needs. When we've gone undercover at Smithfield Foods or recently at Seaboard or these other major producers, pre-stage farms, we have found animals, you know, immobilized. They have pressure sores. They have muscle loss. They have bone density loss. These are not good outcomes from an animal welfare perspective, although they may be good outcomes from a production perspective. We've argued that you cannot separate economics and values. You know, we don't leave our values at the front door of our business when we go to work. We have to infuse our values in everything that we do. And factory farming has been a race for low cost and production at the expense of animals and the environment and a lot of public health concerns. The antibiotics are a great example. The overuse of these antibiotics.
Well, let's bring into the conversation now Hal Herzog, who's been with us before on this program. He's a Western Carolina University psychology professor and author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Welcome, Hal. Good to have you back on the program.
Nice to be back, Frank. I'm a big fan of both your other guests.
Well, we've been talking about, of course, this mixed reaction to animals. What about this? You know, Wayne says, look, the rise in pet ownership suggests a need to feel a connection with nature. At the same time, we seem to be inured and willfully ignorant about the treatment of the animals that we eat. What's happening there?
Well, I think that's exactly the problem. On the one hand, we love animals. On the one hand, we love to eat them. And, you know, my argument is that humans are natural meat eaters, but we're also the only species that has the ability to think morally about these issues and decide we don't want to do what our genes want us to do, but we're still caught in this dilemma. So, for example, if you look at the math, if you look at how much money Americans spend on animals each year, we find, you know, depending on how you do the math, we spend sometimes you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 times more on killing animals than we do on taking care of them and loving them and donating money to animal protection organizations. So there's this built-in schizophrenia about our relationships with these species that are so important in our lives.
Wayne talked about a natural bond, Hal, that we have with animals. Do you think that exists?
I think it does to some extent, but it's also influenced tremendously by culture. And so, for example, animals that are venerated in some cultures are despised in another culture. Dogs are a perfect example. There are cultures in which people gleefully and regularly torture animals. I think there is a natural affinity to animals. You see it in little kids. Been talking recently to people that told me about how much their kids are just attracted to animals, dogs and cats and stuff like that. We know that even newborn infants are attracted to snakes. They're not afraid of them. They're attracted to them. So I think there is something to that. But I think that culture can change these desires around in so many different ways.
Well, Brian, let me take you off into the ozone a little bit and well beyond the scope of your research, but let's have some fun. Let's talk about domestication and the kinds of adaptation we make and the fact that we have to socialize ourselves. We see whole societies socialize and adjust to despotic regimes.
Mm-hmm.
They accept the terror. Here in the United States, we've seen an erosion of our own civil liberties. We've accepted it without a whimper or without much talk. There are tens of thousands of innocent civilians that have been killed abroad in our name, in the name of our safety. Not a whole lot of complaint about that from Americans. And we see, of course, the disproportionate number of poor people sent to prison, executed. And again, not a lot of complaint. So when you think about now the treatment of animals and sort of how economically it works, it's cheap food. I mean, is this a kind of domestication, a sort of self-domestication that we put ourselves through culturally?
Well, it's not impossible. A lot of people, when you think of evolution, you think that it happened a long time ago. But that's actually not true. If you just look at the effort that we're making trying to deal with antibiotic resistant bacteria, you can become a quick believer in evolution. And so evolution happens. It happens all the time. And so when you do anything that reduces variability in a population that is genetic, well, that's going to be evolution. And so if there is, and this is very dangerous territory because some horrible things have happened in history when people start thinking like this, because as soon as it becomes political, it becomes awful. But if there is something, if there's a biological basis where there's genetic variability that causes you to be more or less aggressive, you could potentially select out one area of variability. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the United States has so many people in prisons, for instance. Well, if being in prison makes it much more difficult to reproduce, and if, and it's a huge if there is some percentage of that population that has a genetic predisposition, then you could potentially self-domesticate yourself.
Wayne?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about your broad observation about, you know, why are we tolerating this sort of thing? I mean, we have standards, as Hal writes so well in his book, against cruelty in society, yet we're not logically applying the standard. And I think that we as a society recognize that certain acts are outside of the normal range of behavior, dogfighting, vicious cruelty. But then there are other behaviors that are normalized. They become, you know, part of our economy. They become part of our culture, factory farming, these sorts of things. So a lot of people don't even posit these uses or mistreatment of animals as a moral problem because it is so normalized. And I think this is what we at HSUS are coming to question. Hey, even if this is a legal practice, even if this is a well-established multi-billion dollar industry, we still have to think about our behavior. And we should find a better way. I call in my book for the creation of a new humane economy where we marry our commerce with our values. And that's the sort of economy that we want to build and we've been trying to build in our society for so long.
Let's go back to the phones. Raymond is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Raymond.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just had a quick question. We've heard a lot about dogs, but I was wondering about cats and if cats chose us or if we chose them for pest control or whatever. I know they were deified in Egypt, and I just wanted to know if there's any research on cats.
I think cats just choose everything for themselves, don't they?
Yeah, I'm not a cat owner, but
thanks for the call, Raymond. Yeah, what do you think?
No, the story on cats is very similar. You have settlement, and as soon as we become quite effective at being agriculturalists, we start storing food. And when you start storing food, that attracts rodents. You start attracting rodents, and you attract their predators. And so essentially you can see the same process playing out where cats choose us. And you have to get over your fear of humans also, and right. So then they become—
Well, and you have to stop chasing the cat out of the bin, right, out of the grain
right.
bin. And if it looks big
right.
and ferocious, you're going to—
That's right. That's right. You wouldn't want a self-domesticated lion, for instance.
Exactly.
I've got a question for Brian on that. Actually,
yeah.
I read your paper yesterday, Brian, and one of the things, you know, I've got a cat, and unlike dogs, you point out in your paper that dogs get along really amazingly well. They don't kill each other and stuff like that, but cats do. And there was a paper that came out a year or two ago by David McConnell's group, and he argued that cats have really only been domesticated for about 200 years. And when you look at the physiological things that you look at, you know, brain size and stuff like that, do you see the same thing with cats as you do with dogs, or are they a different breed when it comes to domestication?
Well, here's the soft underbelly of the argument of cats, which is that when you try to figure out what's going on with dogs, you compare them to wolves because we know that wolves are the closest relative. But there is no comparison. We have never done the studies comparing cats to their wild progenitor, their wild ancestor.
So we're not quite sure how they look or what kind of even genetic changes that have taken place.
That's right.
But certainly not more sociable. They don't seem to want to socialize with humans or
each other
as much.
So the evolutionary question would be, are they more social than their wild ancestor was? And so the prediction would be, they may not be as social as dogs, but they're much more social than their wild ancestor would have been.
My cat is very social. never leaves me alone.
Hal, what do you think are the biggest changes that you've seen in the last couple of decades in the way humans react and interact with animals?
Well, I think the biggest change, I think the biggest success of the animal protection movement has not been the obvious things, which is meat. I think we're still eating almost as much meat as we did. In fact, we're eating a lot more meat than we did when the animal liberation movement first started. I think it's been with the sort of moralization of purebred dogs and the rise of taking shelter dogs and the whole spay and neuter program. So we used to kill maybe 30 million dogs and cats in animal shelters each year, and now we're down to 4 million. I think that's really been due to a major efforts by the Humane Society and the HSUS and other groups to get people to think about responsible pet ownership. And I think in terms of success of the animal protection movement, I think that's been the biggest single thing. I'd be interested in Wayne's take on that.
Wayne?
Well, I think the change is happening at a really fast pace. And I think there are a lot of signature wins, but that issue has commanded the greatest share of resources within animal protection. If you think about 3,500 shelters and then 12,000 rescue groups for dogs and cats, 15,000 of the 20,000 groups are dog and cat organizations. So it's logical, and I agree entirely with Hal. But I also think something that he writes very interestingly in his book, about cockfighting. He spent some time with cockfighters, mm-hmm. and even I talk about this in my book, that with cockfighting, we've made it criminal in all 50 states. Dog fighting is a felony in all 50 states. Malicious cruelty is a felony in 47 states. We're just trying to knock off the last three. But even here with dog fighting, I talk about Michael Vick in my book as well as cockfighting, and Hal captures it that even in this, you see something that's more complex than first meets the eye. That you would think, okay, people are dog fighting, cockfighting, they hate animals. These people have them around because they are fascinated by the animals. They admire their musculature, their physical beauty. They think of themselves as caretakers. Of course, then they allow the animals to rip each other apart, either with the metal blades or the ice picks that they strap onto the rooster's legs or with the fangs, the teeth of the dogs who are placed in a pit. But there's so much to this bond and there's so much to this contradiction at work. And I think we're still trying to sort these things out. And it's toughest to deal with the biggest industries that have the best defenses. Like the Farm Bureau and the pork producers, they're really well developed in terms of defending their activities. They've got lots of political connections. So we're just in the last decade beginning to make progress in stopping extreme confinement of animals on factory farms, and we still have quite a ways to go.
You think we are making progress?
Without question. We just got McDonald's to announce last Monday that it would squeeze out pork coming from operations that use these confinement crates, the gestation crates. When you get the biggest restaurant chain in the world, and that's the latest of many big food retailers that have done this, we're making progress. We've passed laws in 8 states or 9 states to restrict this confinement, but we still have a long way to go.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, author of the book The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them. Going to be speaking at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh tonight, 7:30, and then at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Friday at 5:30. Also with us, Hal Herzog, Western Carolina University psychology professor, author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Brian Hare, assistant professor at Duke's Institute for Brain Sciences. Thank all of you for being on the program. Great to have you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Happy to do it.
Thank you for listening to our program, The State of Things, which is a production, as you know, of North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.